next speaker is John Shelton Reed. John's a friend of the university. He's visited here often. Brad McCullough from Montrose. John, we did our field trip to Greensboro a couple years back. John and Dale came. John and Dale joined us. And we appreciate him joining us once again. I'll tell you a little bit about John if you don't already know. He's Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, where he was the director of the Howard Odom Institute for Research in Social Science for 12 years and helped found the university's Center for the Study of the American South. He's written or edited over a dozen books, including 1001 Things Everyone Should Know About the South with his wife, Dale Volberg Reed. He's a contributing writer to the Oxford American Magazine, a founding co-editor of the Quarterly Southern Cultures. He's been a Guggenheim Fellow. He's coined such terms as life beneath the Smith and Wesson line, and made one of the more enduring comments about barbecue in the American South, which I've cribbed many, many times, which is barbecue is the closest thing that we have to the wines and shit. Am I taking this out of your talk? Well, no one knows where I'm going with white yet, so I'll stop.
Time I got through that is far too long, so I'm just going to plow ahead with what I was planning to say. You can put in your own cross references and footnotes and think of it as a review if you want to. We'll have a little test later this morning. Brother Edge asked me if I'd be interested in speaking, of course I jumped at the chance because I knew this was going to be too good a time to pass up. But I didn't really have hadn't really thought about what I might say. And a couple of weeks later he called back and said, I need a title from you. And I said, oh, John, just make something up. So he did. And this title, Barbecue Sociology, The Meat of the Matter, is his coinage. I love it. I'm going to use it again. I still don't have any idea what it means. But like many country songs, this talk may go downhill from the title. I hope not. Anyway, there I was. I had a title, but I didn't have a talk, so I started working on it, and I began to get the heebie-jeebies because, where do I get off standing up in front of, talking about a subject in front of the people that I go to when I want to know something about it? And what in the world is barbecue sociology? So what I'm going to do this morning first is talk about some data. That's a sociological thing to do, and then I want to talk about some subjects that keep coming up, have already come up, about how barbecue brings people together and how it divides them. That's conflict and consensus, two good sociological topics. And then I'm going to shift into anthropological mode and share with you a few ethnographic observations about the culture of competition barbecue, might call barbaculture. Based on one time that I was a judge at Memphis in May. And finally, I'm going to put in a word for the kind of barbecue that I grew up with in East Tennessee. Now, not that I'm any sort of expert. I was one of a couple of hundred judges at Memphis in May, and that was before they had any standards. And the only reason I was a judge was my sister knew the woman that picks the judges. But in the course of writing about the South over the last 30-odd years, I do seem to have wound up writing and talking right much about Southern food in general and smoked meat in particular. To put some numbers on it, when Dale and I wrote a book called 1001 Things Everyone Should Know About the South that John mentioned, roughly 1% of those 1001 things, 8 of them to be precise, dealt with barbecue. And the sentence that John started to quote is the second most quoted sentence I've ever written. I'm embarrassed to say you can find these things out on the internet. It's like some pathetic day trader checking his stock portfolio. The second most quoted sentence I ever wrote is this one. It's from a review of Greg Johnson and Ben Staton's book, Real Barbecue. Southern barbecue is the closest thing we have in the United States to Europe's wines or cheeses. Drive 100 miles and the barbecue changes. Now, I'll get to the most quoted sentence I ever wrote in a minute, but I don't think you can really understand the South if you don't understand barbecue, understand it properly as food and process and event. If you look at that map that I handed out, it shows you where a few years ago you could find restaurants affiliated with the National Barbecue Association. Now, we all know that many of the best barbecue joints aren't the kind of place that would join, or for that matter, even know about something called the National Barbecue Association. Nevertheless, if you'll observe where the dots are concentrated, you'll see that for the time being, at least, barbecue is Southern. Now, y'all knew that. But as the map shows, it has started to metastasize. It's popping up wherever large numbers of expatriate Southerners are found, and of course that's no surprise because that's who cooks it. Southerners who took their tastes and techniques with them, often during the great migration out of the South in the first half of the last century. Now those migrants followed well-established migration paths, and so did the barbecue. And in the process, it recapitulated some of the internal divisions within the South that Lola's talked about, and I'll say some more about in a minute. There's a place Dale and I used to go to in East Palo Alto, for example, where, yes, you could get pork ribs, but you could also get beef brisket and hot links and bologna, and the guy who ran it was about 80 years old and came from Texas, you know, like many of the Southerners on the West Coast who come from Texas and Oklahoma and Louisiana. Similarly, you go to Chicago, you get ribs cooked by Mississippians and West Tennesseans, first or second or third generation now. And in the Northeast, you find the distinctive barbecues of the Carolinas and Georgias, cooked and seasoned with techniques that came north on the chicken bone special. Now, as Lola said, to be sure, barbecue, like jazz, sometimes changed after it left the South. And in my opinion, like jazz, not always for the better. A few years ago, I read about a place in New York called Carolina that served mesquite grilled pork on a bed of lettuce with Dijon mustard. just last May, just a few months ago, Dale and I ate at the Arkansas barbecue in the old Spitalfields Market in East London, which is where that sign on your handout came from. Now, the proprietor actually comes from Maryland, but he has changed his name to Bubba. And he cooks pretty good pulled pork and brisket, but he caters to English taste by serving them with mushy peas. Anyway, barbecue may someday escape its native Southern matrix and become an all-American institution, the way Coca-Cola did a century ago. And as NASCAR and country music and the Southern Baptist Convention may be doing today. But it hasn't happened yet. Even in the East End of London, barbecue is still seen not just as a Southern food, but almost as the Southern food. Which makes it odd that there are some conspicuous parts of the South that are not especially good places to find it. I mean towns and cities that have got above their raising, or anyway want to get above it. You may know Clyde Edgerton's, some of you may know Clyde Edgerton's country song that goes, "I'm a quiche lady in a barbecue town." Anybody? Well, in some southern towns, there are a great many quiche ladies of both sexes, domestic and imported, and in many, there's many towns, there's so many that they call the shots, and what you get then is a quiche town. Atlanta, I fear, is one of them. Sorry, Jim. You can still find good barbecue in Atlanta, I know that, but most of the joints, in my experience, are hidden away. They're off the beaten track in obscure and sometimes unsavory neighborhoods. Harold's is one of the best. It's over near the prison. There used to be a pretty good place on Peachtree Street called Wileen's, but it closed. I'm told, am I right, that the Auburn Rib Shack is gone now?
The Neon Pig is now displayed at the Atlanta
History Center. All right, the Neon Pig from the Auburn Rib Shack is in the Atlanta History Center. That says it all right there. Just down from the Ebenezer Baptist Church used to be here. It's almost as if downtown Atlanta is ashamed of barbecue. Actually, I'm being polite. They are ashamed of barbecue. When the Olympics came to town, the fellow who was in charge of arranging to feed the crowds was a friend of mine from North Carolina. He lined up a local African-American concessionaire to welcome the world to Georgia with a wonderful array of Southern food, most definitely including barbecue. But as I heard it anyway, the Atlanta Olympic Organizing Committee, desperately eager that the world should understand that Atlanta is a cosmopolitan place, a world-class major league city, as a welcoming sign at the airport used to say. When they saw the proposed menu, they vetoed it, and they hired a fast food firm, a food service firm from Buffalo, to sell hot dogs and hamburgers. I promised you the most quoted sentence I've ever written. Here it is. Every time I look at Atlanta, I see what 250,000 Confederate soldiers died to prevent. Now, one of the reasons I like Texans so much is their attitude toward barbecue. You know, you go to Dallas, there's Sonny Bryant's right downtown, just like Neiman Marcus, you know. You go to Houston, good company's right out in public where people can find it. You know, these places say, welcome to Texas. You know, have some Texas food. You know, we like it and you will too. There are some southern cities with barbecue pride. But of course, the real home of real barbecue is in the small town south. In North Carolina, you don't find it in Charlotte, say, but in Shelby, which is an hour west. When Dale and I are in Charlotte, we drive to Shelby for supper because you can get barbecue as good as you've ever had at either of the two wonderful establishments that Bob Garner mentioned yesterday, Alston Bridges or Bridges Barbecue Lodge. Now, if you're anywhere near, check it out and be sure to ask for burnt ends. Seriously, if you start listing great barbecue towns, Lexington, North Carolina, Vince Staten found 16 barbecue joints in Lexington for a town of 16,000 people. Goldsboro, Owensboro, Kentucky, or Lockhart, just start listing the famous places. The only barbecue mecca that's over 100,000 population, the only one over 50,000, is Memphis. South's other cities may have barbecue, sometimes good barbecue, but it's not a religion. And in many of them, the best barbecue on offer these days seems to be at branches of barbecue chains. Let me say a word about that development. It was Rousseau who memorably observed the paradox that man is born free but is found everywhere in chains. Expansion is not good for barbecue joints. That's a rule almost as reliable as Vince Staten's maxim that a place without flies is no good. You should ask what the flies know that you don't. I'm sorry, but Dreamland in Birmingham just isn't as good as Dreamland in Tuscaloosa. If the owner's not around to keep an eye on things, it's a pretty safe bet that both the food and the atmosphere will suffer. And it's especially sad when a chain imports somebody else's traditions to a place that ought to celebrate its own. I think about this every time I eat Memphis dry ribs at Red Hot and Blue in Chapel Hill or at Corky's in Jackson, which is often. Because when it comes to barbecue, the truth is the worst I ever had was good, as Dave Gardner once observed on another subject. At least I think he was talking about another subject. Sometimes hard to tell with Brother Dave. Anyway, I think places with local barbecue traditions should shun synthetic tradition, even if it comes from Memphis and tastes pretty good. When I have a choice, I prefer the local product, ideally served up in a cinder block building with a dancing pig sign out front. One reason I prefer it has nothing to do with the food. And here we come to that cohesion I mentioned earlier. If you go into one of these joints in a small southern town, you're quite likely to find that it has brought together all kinds of unlikely people. Just about everybody but quiche ladies. got businessmen, you got construction workers, you got lawyers, you got farmers, you got cowboys and hippies, black and white, and everything in between. And sideways, you've got Protestants, you've got Catholics, you've even got Jews, as we heard yesterday. Some of you may know the old Smokehouse Barbecue in Anniston, Alabama, run by Gershon Weinberg. Okay. You heard the phrase root hog? It's kind of kosh root hog. I once suggested half seriously that if the South needs a new flag, as it surely does, we could do worse than to use a dancing pig with a knife and fork. You want to talk about heritage, not hate. That's a heritage we all share and can take pride in it. So there's a little sociology. Barbecue both symbolizes and contributes to community, and that's without even mentioning its non-commercial manifestations in matters like fundraising for volunteer fire departments. But there's another side to this coin. It's often the case, and it is in this one too, that community is reinforced by emphasizing one's differences from and with outsiders. And there's no denying that barbecue can be divisive. Drive 100 miles and the barbecue does change, and so do opinions about what barbecue ought to be. The only constant is slow cooking with smoke, and yes, I know some places cook with gas and call their product barbecue, but I don't. Suppose we go with the southeastern majority and cook pork. Well, then we'll argue about what kind of wood to cook it with, whether we're going to cook shoulder ribs or whole hog, what kind of sauce we're going to use on it, vinegar, tomato, mustard, how hot, how sweet, will we baste it or not, forget the sauce, go with the dry rub. When the meat's done, we can argue about what the divinely ordained side dishes are. Brunswick stew and hush puppies, sliced white bread, tamales. You ever been to McClard's in Hot Springs, Arkansas? Coleslaw, I guess, is almost universal, but I've only seen boiled white potatoes in eastern North Carolina, rice only in South Carolina, jalapenos only in Texas and Oklahoma. These questions of what to cook and how to cook it and what to serve with it are not resolved by the individual whim or creativity of the cook. Barbecue cooks are like Byzantine icon painters. They differ in technique and skill, but they're working in traditions that pretty much tell them what to produce. And those traditions reflect and reinforce the fierce localism that has always been a Southern characteristic, the sense of place that literary folk claim to find in Southern fiction, the devotion to states' rights and local autonomy that was an established characteristic of Southern politics long before it became a major headache for the Confederate States of America. I wrote once that barbecue is not like grits in more ways than the obvious. Grits, if you will excuse the image, glue the South together. Barbecue, on the other hand, you could say it pits community against community, but that's pretty lame folks. This competitive aspect of barbecue has been institutionalized in the formal contests that seem to have become a permanent feature of the Southern landscape. Last time I looked, something called the Sanctioned Barbecue Contest Network sponsored some 30 major contests a year, and the schedules in a fat newspaper called National Barbecue News suggested that there were enough minor league contests to keep you busy most weekends if you're inclined that way, and some folks are. One of the biggest, I guess the biggest and the best known, is Memphis in May, where I got to be a judge a few years back. I wrote about it for a magazine that I'm pretty sure most of you don't read. So let me share with you a few impressions from my field notes. Memphis in May offers not just great barbecue, but a complete barbecultural experience. Elvis impersonators, people selling plastic pig snouts, campaigning politicians, and evangelists handing out leaflets on what to do in case you missed the rapture. The year I was there, there was not a street mime in sight. Saturday night entertainment on the big stage the year I was there was provided by the Reverend Billy C. Wirtz, who some of you may know, a boogie-woogie piano player. composer of such songs as Mennonite Surf Party, Your Greens Give Me the Blues, and Stick Out Your Can Because Here Comes the Garbage Man. This contest, if you haven't been there, takes place on a park right down smack on the banks of the Mississippi. You can smell the hickory smoke a half mile away. My year, there were 180 some odd teams, some of them odder than others. There was a contestant who called himself MC Hamhock. did a rap number that went, "Don't need no knife, don't need no fork, just wrap your lips around my pork." Two weekends ago, I was in San Antonio, saw a sign that went that one better. It said, "You don't need no teeth to eat Bob's meat." Now, these teams come in all sizes and degrees of organization. There are mom-and-pop teams that just set up folding lawn chairs and sit around. But there are other teams that build these giant two- and three-story structures that have lattice work and statuary and decks and hanging plants and all this stuff. Each team has a name. Many of them have mottos, like "Hogs Smell Better Barbecued." "We Serve No Swine Before It's Time." It's a very noisy place. I was surprised to discover there are giant portable generators that are powering everything from fountains to electric fans to neon signs. But so there's a constant drone. But over it, they have these mighty sound systems that pump out music, mostly country or Cajun or rap. But when I was there, I also heard YMCA, actually. smokers range from little backyard Weber pots to, they had an 18-wheeler thing built as the world's largest portable barbecue cooker. Most of them were what we saw yesterday, just kind of coffin-sized things. Some of them obviously off the rack, but a lot of them were made from 55-gallon drums and stovepipe. And everywhere you looked there, you would see the pig totem of the people of the swine. Now, for many years, I've kept a mental log of barbecue joint signs, like the ones on the pictures for sale in the back. I had seen pigs reclining and running and dancing, pigs with bibs and knives and forks, pigs with crowns and scepters. I'd seen pigs winning beauty contests. I'd seen pigs in Confederate uniforms. I'd seen pigs in cowboy hats, one of them playing a banjo. I'd seen Mr. and Mrs. Pig dressed for a night on the town, and Mr. and Mrs. Pig as American Gothic. But I had never seen pigs like I saw in Memphis. There were pigs in chef's hats and volunteer firemen's helmets. There was a pig in a Memphis State football uniform, triumphant over some University of Tennessee pigs. There was a pig in a Superman suit rising from the flames. There was a pig reclining on a skillet, another one on a grill drinking beer. There were two pigs basting a little gnomish human being on a spit. There was a whole trainload of partying pigs on the t-shirts of a team called the Rowdy Southern Swine from Kossuth, Mississippi. It's a hard call. My favorite was probably some pigs with wings and halos from a team called Hog Heaven. Among the humans, well, the temperature was well over 90 degrees in the shade, so most men wore shorts and t-shirts, which revealed all too plainly what beer and barbecue can do to the male physique. Female attire ran to halter tops and cutoffs. Often these cutoffs had been decorated with stickers that had been lovingly applied to passing butts by freelance inspectors wearing plastic pig noses. The stickers said things like, "Hot," "Can't touch this," and "USDA choice." Now, I'm a professor, and I run across some strange books. One of them I'd run across not that long before was a sort of, it was billed as a feminist vegetarian monograph called The Sexual Politics of Meat. I thought about that as I was walking around Memphis. If this poor author had been dropped down there on the banks of the Mississippi with me, she would probably have been carried off gibbering. Anyway, as I said, I was not particularly qualified to be a judge, and I was worried that I was out of my depth, but they had an orientation session for us. and that put my mind at ease because we started with the basics. First thing the instructor said was, if you don't eat pork, please let us know. Talked about deportment, urged us to stay sober till after the judging, and brought up ethics. I remember he said, if your ex-wife's boyfriend is on a team, you should disqualify yourself. Well, I'll cut this short. I was judging in the ribs division, and next day when the pork met the palate, I got to sample three very fine plates of ribs, but I was pleased to discover that I could discriminate among them. The best ones I had were cooked by those Mississippians from Kosuth. I tried to describe the taste, and I came away with a new respect for even greater respect for people who can write about food, because I just couldn't begin to do it justice, especially the sauces. Trying to write about sauces, I come up with stuff. I'll read you a couple of examples, not because I'm proud of them, quite the contrary, but some of the flavors. I sound like Southern Living in one of them. A symphony of Southern flavors. Tart sea island tomatoes, mellow onions from Vidalia, sweet and sour molasses from Louisiana cane fields, and the Latin kick of peppers from South Texas. A sauce the color of Tennessee clay with the fiery heat of an Alabama afternoon and the long, slow sweetness of the Kentucky evening. Well, scratch that. Try it again, sounding like a wine critic. A sauce of great character and finesse. Bright claret color with a complex peppery nose. Lusty, full-bodied taste. Tomato ketchup and chili, the principal notes, with a definite garlic background and hints of, could it be grape jelly? Balance sustained throughout, an assertive finish and a pronounced afterburn. I just made all that up, actually, except the grape jelly, which I'll bet anything was the secret ingredient in one of the sauces I tasted. Well, speaking of sauces, Bob Garner was talking yesterday about another long-standing rivalry, that between Eastern and Western North Carolina. Let me close with a few words about that. Just last month, as I was struggling with this, a writer named Carol Leggett set off a new battle in that ancient war with a column in the Raleigh magazine about the barbecue that he was raised with, which was East Carolina-style chopped whole hog barbecue with vinegar and red pepper. Basically, he said he likes it, but he said it at great length. He even likes the surprises that chopped whole hog offers. Let me quote him. He says, at Eastern barbecue shrines, kids sit in wonderment every meal and fish objects from their barbecue. Hey, Mom, what's this, they ask. That's just gristle, Antoine. That's just skin, Ashley. That's just a piece that cooked too long, Latonia. That's just a little old piece of bone pudding. I don't know what it is, Sean. Wow, just shut up and eat it. Now, if Leggett had just extolled his native style of barbecue, no one would have minded, but he went on to deprecate Western Lexington-style barbecue. He described it as mere roasted pork shoulders chopped and mixed with a thick tomato sauce that masks the meat's flavor and textural sameness. He complained about the lack of special parts to vie for, even with its implication that there are, well, other parts. That put the fat in the fire. Within days, there was a website where Tar Heels could vote for our preferences for Eastern or Western. And I was getting email from friends and acquaintances and total strangers across the state urging me to vote. One pointed out I could vote once a day and begged me to do so. Now, I found it interesting that all these lobbyists apparently assumed that I, like all reasonable people, shared their preference. In truth is, I like both Tar Heel varieties. You know, to paraphrase Will Rogers, I've almost never met a smoked pig I didn't like. I've never said in public whether I like Eastern or Western better. State employees are supposed to stay out of politics. Besides, Chapel Hill, where I live, is right on the border anyway, and after 33 years, I'm still a Tennessean outlander, so I keep my head down when these interstate battles flare up. But here in Mississippi, out of the crossfire, I will confess to you that I really do like sweet red sauce on my barbecue. Maybe this shouldn't be surprising since East Tennessee, where I'm from, used to be Western North Carolina, far Western North Carolina. Let me close by talking about the kind of barbecue I grew up with. I'm going to talk about a joint in Piney Flats, Tennessee, called simply the Ridgewood. Incidentally, it was founded and run for many decades by a woman, Mrs. Grace Prophet. Now, when you think of those great barbecue towns that I mentioned, Piney Flats does not come to mind. In fact, nowhere in East Tennessee comes to mind. But right outside Bluff City, midway between Johnson City and Bristol, is this modest-looking place that since 1948 has served what People magazine once called the best barbecue in the country and therefore obviously in the world. Okay, I hear you say, what does People magazine know about barbecue? Well, try this. The Ridgewood is the only out-of-state establishment that Bob Garner mentions in his book, North Carolina Barbecue. Now, given Tar Heel chauvinism in these matters, that's testimonial indeed. Although, to be sure, Bluff City is only 25 miles from the North Carolina line. Now, when I was a boy, people drove a long way to eat at the Ridgewood, despite notoriously capricious hours and service that ranged from brusque to surly. That service was almost as legendary as the food. In real barbecue, Vince Staten, who grew up in Dale's in my hometown of Kingsport also, Vince Staten quoted a devotee of the Ridgewood who said that going there was like going to the Don Rickles restaurant. Well, last month, Dale and I went back there with Fred Sausman, and the place has changed a bit. We were almost disappointed to have a waitress who was downright pleasant. We were also disappointed to find squeeze bottles of sauce on the tables. In the old days, Mrs. Prophet had definite ideas about how much sauce to use, a lot. And she poured it over the thin sliced pork before it was served, and you ate what was put before you. So the times, they are a-changing. But so far, the barbecue at the Ridgewood has not. It's good pork, it's well-smoked, and it's served with a fabulous sauce, and that's the combination that has drawn folks to the Ridgewood for a half century now. You got a handout about that sauce, recipe for something that tastes pretty much like it. The appropriately named Fred Sausman has brought a supply of the actual Ridgewood sauce, and it will be available to you tonight. You can sample it. I hope you'll agree with me that the flavor is marvelously complex. You know, vinegar and red pepper is East Carolina minimalism. This is over mountain Baroque, right? I've already talked about how hard it is to describe barbecue sauces, but I will close with this. To the Carroll Leggetts of this world, to all East Carolinians, I say only, this is what ketchup will taste like in heaven. Thank you.